Okay, so, wow, depleted ranks. Gets really cozy in here. First name basis, okay. Have to draft some MTA guys to come. Fill in the chairs, okay, chair fillers. MTA guys good for anyway, like chair fillers, right? Just teasing you guys, just see if you're awake. You know, just okay, so, sad parsha. This is the great fall of history. Second chance, gone wrong. Am Yisrael was still rooted to enter Eretz Yisrael even after the Chareigel. This is really the turning point of the Torah. It's not lodged in the middle, but we talked last week about the double nuns. Now the double nuns, at least according to Rabbi Soloveitchik, indicated the inversion of history, the ideal historical arc of the beginning of Bamidbar, which was left unfulfilled, and the rerouted fallen historical arc of the end of Bamidbar, 40 years of the desert, which is a symbol of general wandering and lack of redemptive history. 38 years, not 40 years, but 38 years of radio silence. And what's even more frustrating is it's the leadership that's responsible. And it's a lesson sometimes that faulty leadership, you can't replace good leadership. And sometimes it's underappreciated. And again, leadership, I don't mean leadership by charisma and attention, and leadership by just people bearing responsibility. And this is responsibility. Responsibility is to have equanimity and composure and perspective and not to panic. And we'll talk about the panic that was struck. That's real leadership, is to become in the eye of the storm. And we've spoken so often about how that word, every time I really want to like rip it out of the newspaper. A leadership training seminar, come for the summer, it's like a catch. What does leadership mean? It doesn't mean because you're the head. It means because you give inspiring. You're at the center with your guitar. You're the head of the organ. That means when there's a difficult moment, you show confidence. When there's stress, you're calm. When there's you bear responsibility, you suffer first. Or, you have to be really, really careful about those terms. It's a really, really tantalizing word today. Leadership in the self-promotional world of Facebook should not be associated with attention, center, running, organizing. That's not convincing people. How do you convince people? Right? You go to a leadership. How do you convince people? None of that. That could be stronger. That could be bully. That could be leveraging. It's not. So what makes it so frustrating is that the leaders who should be carrying, that's what they do, they carry, they should be giving gifts, which they gave in the end of Nusso, on behalf of, they should be representing, they're the ones who are scandalizing and libelizing Eretz Yisrael and mocking Eretz Yisrael and panicking in the face of adversity. And it's a backdrop, of course, for a tragedy, but it's also a backdrop for the emergence of two people that aren't swayed and two people that are able to withstand this mutiny and able to almost turn the tide. They're almost successful. They fail. They ask Kalev Issam, Kalev and Yoshua. And you ask yourself, what gave these two people their core? What gave these two people their resiliency? And that's what you want to find out. You want to find out, you want to be a leader, how can you be a Yoshua? How can you be strong in the face of mob rule? How can you adopt positions which aren't popular but are correct? How can you see reality even when it's being distorted and perverted by panic? And what do you go to? What do you go to when there's chaos and mayhem and bedlam and everyone's seeing things the wrong way and taking cowardly approaches? How do you see, you know, Tova Aretz, Tova Aretz Maod Maod, and Kodesh Baruch Hu Yecholucha? How do you become that person? So there's an interesting contrast between Yoshua and Moshe. That's what makes this parsha so easy, so transparent. It's okay, because we're always looking for dualities, we're always looking for contrast. Two dinim, tzvei dinim, how do you approach it? And of course, you want to complement the two. So, what are the tzvei dinim in this team of Yoshua and Kalev? Because they seem very different. So, Yoshua, we've seen before. And all that history, it climaxes in Parsha Shlach, because what's Yoshua's source of strength? Moshe Rabbeinu. Nar Yoshua le'amish b'toch ohel. Even in last week's parsha, we see Yoshua's dedication to Moshe almost to a fault. He's too dedicated to Moshe. He's too hurt. He's too insulted. Moshe says to Yoshua, take the emotion out of this decision. This is not a decision about me. This is a decision about Am Yisrael. In a broader national perspective, I wish everyone were Nevi'im. Remember those two renegade Nevi'im who are going around prophesizing Eldad or Medad? So Yoshua takes it all personal and gets all hot and gets all agitated. Moshe says, it's not about Lee. Everyone misses that part. I spoke last week about the second part of the pasuk. That it's better to be religiously driven, even if it expresses itself inappropriately. You maintain kolam Hashem neviim. But the first part of the pasuk is Take it's not about me. It's not about affecting me and attacking me. There are larger dynamics at work, and Yeshua gets a little bit too patriotic, too jingoistic about Moshe Rabbeinu's honor. But he's dedicated to Moshe, and he waits very patiently by the foot of the mountain in Parshas Ki Tisa. It takes a lot of guts to be, remember, guts get you killed during the days of the eagle. Chor gets murdered because he shows some guts. So Yeshua is endangering his life by parting the way. So Aaron had to cave. Aaron had all sorts of ulterior motives, but in the end he caved because the threat was too great. So Yeshua, separating himself and waiting by the mountain for Moshe, is tagging himself as the oppositional force. And tagging himself as the oppositional force, on this day we'll get you killed. But he's dedicated to Moshe. And in Parshas B'Shalach, Yeshua is Moshe's general, B'char Lanu Anashim, and they work hand in hand. It's almost as if one is a puppeteer and one is a puppet. B'char Lanu Anashim, I'll stand on the mountain and daven, and you direct things beneath. So we've seen Yeshua before. We know his relationship with Moshe Rabbeinu. It's sturdy, it's stout, and can I just ask you to close the door, please? And it is reinforced in this week's Parsha. Before Yeshua departs, Moshe calls him in and changes his name. And it's not just a name change, but it's an iconic name change. Not just adding some arbitrary letter, but it's taking Hoshea and converting it to Shem Hashem. Kal Yoshiacha Metzas Meragnam. So now you walk with God. Now your name is not just to help, but Kal Yoshiacha, Rashi's Drasha, of course, it can mean any sorts, but again, the Yod, even at a literal level, is an iconic. There's certain iconic letters. Yod is an iconic letter. Aleph is an iconic letter. Taf is an iconic letter. Mem. So these are letters that stand out. So Moshe doesn't call him Yehoshua. He calls him Joshua. He calls him, well, I don't know, is that your name? He calls him Yehoshua. Puts the Yud there. Rashi quotes the Drasha of Chazal, Koyashiach. But either way, it's latent in the words, it's latent in the letters. It's a sign of confidence, it's a sign of empowerment, it's a sign of expectation, it's a sign of mission. Remember, when you expect great things from people, they tend to live up to your expectation. It's the best way to motivate people, if we're talking about that elusive little thing called leadership, is to talk them up and to build up expectations, and you do that by your own performance, and you'd be surprised that people rise to the occasion. And when you talk people down and you expect less from them, they probably underperform. So Moshe is raising the bar for Yeshua, and to a degree, Yeshua succeeds. At the very least, again, he can't succeed in reversing the trend, but at least not falling victim to this scandal, to this libel. So Yeshua and Moshe, we know what to expect. We expect Yeshua to succeed in withstanding the Meraglim's controversy. That's clear. And this moment with Moshe just reinforces their relationship. But where does Caleb get the guts? What's his source of strength? What's his secret sauce? What is he? We don't know much about him. He doesn't have any past with Moshe Rabbeinu. He isn't Mishares Moshe. He isn't Nar. He isn't waiting by the tent. And we don't see him speaking to Moshe at all. And in some ways, he's more successful than Yeshua, at least temporarily placating and temporarily arresting the process. In fact, not only does he not have a relationship with Moshe, but it's hard to know how they named, and the names of the Meraglim themselves seem to be very commonplace if you compare. Remember, this is a new team of leaders, a new team of princes. If you look back in the beginning of Bamidbar, there was an entirely different crowd. So now this is a new team, and it's showing the fraying of the political infrastructure. There's a lot of dynamics, a lot of instability. He sends that in Parshas Baloscha, not just with the subversion of Moshe's authority on two fronts. It's Eldad Omeidad who challenged Moshe's authority by prophesizing in an unauthorized fashion. It's a challenge to Moshe. Moshe is the coordinator of Nevuah. He's the Adon HaNevi'im. He says who should and shouldn't offer Nevuah. But at least according to Chazal, they're also prophesizing irreverently about Moshe. The prophecy is not about who's going to win the NBA champion. Their prophecy is about Moshe's early retirement, banned from Eretz Yisrael, new leader. So there's an irreverence, there's an insolence to the prophecy, both in content and in decision and initiative. And then, of course, it's a quick skip and a jump for Aaron and Miriam to start to question Moshe's decision-making, his marital life, his superiority complex, the way they see it. What were you're the only one Hashem speaks to. So you're seeing how the political infrastructure is convulsing in Parshas Baloscha. And there's a realignment, which is necessary, because Moshe's had enough. It's hard to make Moshe flustered. Moshe goes through a lot. Moshe can last 40 days and 40 nights without food and water, but he can't take it anymore. And he says, Kasher Yisrael, Medes Yonik, it's just too much. It takes a lot. And Moshe's flustered, and Hashem realizes it, and delivers the first delegation bureaucracy, S. Felicia Vimish. So a lot of movement, and some of it is natural and evolutionary, because now they're evolving through different people, but some of it is just instability. So you want to have solid, stable, continuous leadership. Sometimes you find these references. You guys probably are involved in sports teams, change their coaches or GMs or owners every year or so. It's hard. It's hard to create stability. Think of it another way. Think of it, if you have to abstract, what is the culture here in Yeshiva? Aside from, I don't mean, did the schnitzel taste good today? Did it not taste good today? It was the shiur good today? Or was it not? Like, what culturally makes this place work? There's continuity. And continuity is important on many levels. Solid leadership. You know what to expect. You walk in here, people come in. I don't know if you've talked to Bogrim that come in, alumni. They haven't been in 20 years. It's the same place. It's not the same place. People are 20 years older. People have left. People have moved on. But it's the same place, because you can sense there's been no institutional reset. It's the same yeshiva. We haven't sold our souls just for five more boys, five less boys. We haven't all of a sudden pressed the institutional reset button. Okay, now a new person's coming in, a new wave. This is a place. Continuity is important. Continuity in family is important. Continuity in relationships is important. You want to know who you're getting that day. You know that, that person, you're going to wake up the same person. I don't have to all of a sudden read that person and understand that person and what that person's mood is. You want to know, okay, you're the same person. I can rely on you. I can rely on that relationship. That's what makes it comfortable, right? You put on a new shoe, your foot hurts. It's pained. When you slip your foot into the old shoe, it just slips right into the shape, because it's all broken in already. You know exactly how that shoe is going to feel when you slip your foot in the next day. You don't have to shoehorn it in, squeeze it in, squeeze your toes. So there's a problem with leadership, and some of it is that you wonder about their names. Some of the names in the beginning of Bamidbar are very, very glorious names. Elitzor, Ben Shteor, and named Reuel. The name of, and all of Hashem's name is part of them. Many. Shlumiel, Ben Sarisha, that has a pretty happy name. He has at his breast, you know, give the kid a bread. Shlumiel, Ben Shlumiel. Wow, it's a heavy name. Like, it reminds me of the Ravami. I'll save it for my Ravami tell stories in the morning. So it's a very famous Ravami tell story about naming people out of bris. And there's a post story to that story. The best Ravami tell stories is when I actually lived through the sequel. Where there was the first story that Ravami tell told, and then I used that story as part of my life. So I'll tell, maybe tomorrow I'll tell you that story. You can ask my nephew about it. I was just kibitzing with him last night. But anyway, so these people, Sesor ben Michael, Gamli ben Sodi ben Rafui, they're all strange names. And Chazal, they have some sinister, Bela ben Bichri, some sinister interpretations of who these people were. Kali doesn't sound sinister, it just sounds very proletariat. It's really not a name you'd give to an aristocrat. We're going to name you after an animal. Okay, maybe not. And it's going to be, and he's waiting, please, lion. Please, bear, the dog. Say, oh no. I have a recall on that one, you know, poor baby. Like, don't name me after a dog. Don't name me Caleb. Caleb is not exactly an elegant animal. So again, it's hard to know whether it's Caleb or Caleb, but the naming here carries. So Hoshea, that's the name. That's the name you'd expect for that type of leader. Go help, a helper. Now all of a sudden you've got someone named Caleb joining ranks. Where does he go? Who does he turn to? In his low moments, when he's got to face his fusillade of acrimony and hostility and scorn and mocking, what does he turn to? What does he call? Who puts his head on the pillow at night in that tent? And all the Meraglim are conspiring on the side. Oh, let's say this, let's do this, and bickering and angry and resentful to Moshe. Where's his emotional fortress of solitude? What does he go to? So Chazal fill in the blanks about color. Okay, Chazal say, source number one, by Alu Banegev, I'm just going to get some more words, that's Alu 1. They all ascended in the south because, as you know, they were in the desert, so to move there to Israel, they have to ascend. By Avar Chevron, and one person arrives in Chevron, and that's weird. They all ascend in the south, but only one person arrives in Chevron. So first of all, as a complete sidebar, this is my favorite Rashi in the entire Torah. Now it's hard because I love Rashi. My favorite Rashi in the entire Torah is Rashi says, oh, they ascended, and after they ascended, someone came to Hebron. It must be that Hebron is one of the higher mountain ranges in Israel. So he sits there going about proving from Sukkim that Hebron is a high mountain range. And I said, oh, great, because Rashi lived in France in the 11th century, and he never got to Israel. I could just open my window, and oh, Hebron is a high altitude. I just feel so historically empowered when I read Rashi turning somersaults in France in the 11th century, trying to prove the altitude of from Har Chevron or Har Chevron, let me go to Rami Levy and stand in the parking lot, and I'll just see Chevron, being on high altitude. So it's a big schus to be able to not need all the proofs that Rashi musters in Vayelot Chevron. So sometimes you have to read Rashi through a historical lens. But Chazal were not discussing the altitude of Chevron. They were describing one lone seceder, one person who secedes from the group. Everyone ascends, but one person comes to Chevron, and we know, of course, it's Kalev. And Kalev davens and Kibrei Avos, and he looks for inspiration, for support, and that's when he gets his strength, not Moshe, because Moshe probably doesn't even know his name. When I read about Moshe and Kalev, Yeshua and Kalev, I think about, I just saw him last week. He lives in Teaneck, he's a good friend of mine. So when I was in Yeshiva, my Chavrusa for many, many years was the son of Rav Lichtenstein's best friend from YU, literally his best friend. Himself a major, major contributor to Jewish causes and real leader in the truest sense, the father. And he's still alive today, Baruch Hashem. Here's Rav Aaron's like friend. They were friends in college, they were friends in the Rav Shir, like friends for 40 years, whatever. And he was my Chavrusa. So Rav Aaron would come over pretty regularly to see if he could help out his friend's son. Do you need anything? Can I take you to Yishalayim? Would you like to come over for Shabbos? You forgot your slippers at my house. You need some lending money. And I was there like, he didn't know. Hello, I'm here. Say something to me. There's no reason to because I was a nobody. I was a silhouette. This guy was Rav Aaron's best friend's son. So there was every reason to go over to him. So it was really cool. Like, I didn't exist, not in a mean way. He just came over and kindly inquired. He knew my name, but there was no relationship. There was no need for him to extend himself as a friend of your father. Like your father's friend. If your father's friend would come over and say, oh, can I help you out with something? So I always think about Kalev. Moshe, do I get any attention here? Do I get any love? You want to give a nice bracha my way? And he doesn't. And he goes to Chevron. Now, there is a dual message here in the dichotomy between Moshe and Yeshua. And I want to talk about two totally separate things that, to me, emerge from this dichotomy. Okay? Number one, what I just alluded to with the story. Number two, it's a little different. It's not about where you come from, but which generation you live in. The first dichotomy is exactly as I painted it. Yeshua is aristocracy. Yeshua's got stories. Yeshua's got a Rebbe. Yeshua's got heritage. Yeshua's got the name. Yeshua's the son of a rabbi. Yeshua's the scion of a dynasty of rabbis. Yeshua's that person, the last name Soloveitchik, Lichtenstein. He's got moxie in the world of Torah. He's got moxie. He's got name recognition. And Kalev is a nobody. And Kalev doesn't have any last name. The Kalev doesn't come from any prestigious family. And I think sometimes, I think we'll leave the window open because we need the air. I think sometimes people that don't come from these real rabbinic or Torah-oriented or even Am Yisrael successful, just come from simple backgrounds and they say, well, I would become that person, and I would choose this lifestyle, but they ask themselves, who am I, and what is my background, and what is my last name, and what was my father? And to a degree, I very deeply resonate with Kalev, because although if I go several generations back, there were some rabbis and some gedolim in my generation, and if I look at my parents, and my father just spoke last night at my son's bar mitzvah, he's been learning for 60 years, since he was in Eretz Yisrael. He's had a chavrusa, I think a 60-year chavrusa. I mean, there's no... He's been through Shas several times, but he wasn't a rabbi. He wasn't so. When I was making my way through and I was with people who were the sons of rabbi, who carried important names, who came from certain masoros, who had stories of Rabbi Soloveitchik, who had stories of Lichtenstein, and I didn't have any of that, it didn't deter me. It didn't say, oh, therefore I can't become. In fact, it motivated me. I said, this is something that I want to leave my mark. I'm not just going to be the next generation of, or this third generation of, or, Jimmy Johnson III, the safety out of Arkansas or something. I'm going to seize this opportunity. So there's a sense that Kalev doesn't feel disempowered because he doesn't have this relationship, this cozy relationship with Moshe Rabbeinu. Is there a wedding? Oh. Oh, so it's going to continue. So it's going to be very disruptive. Why don't we relocate to Rav Amitai's room? Okay? This is going to be more convenient. We have about half an hour or so. Okay? We have, how many people do we have here? We'll figure out the fit in Rav Amitai's room. This is the yeshiva event? Is this the yeshiva event?
No.
What is it? What? where the water is running behind. And second of all, this was a room of shouting, and Ravang Da would shout me out of the room. He didn't like something, like it was very meteoric. He was like, get out, we're never doing that. I said, okay, I'll come back tomorrow. And like, okay, we're doing it. There's a lot of action in this room. There's a lot of dynamics. Things were moving. You know, Ravang's room was very quiet. You said your piece, he said his piece. Thinking back here was a lot of laughing and flatness. This is a different type of a room. So that's one of the differences I wanted you to think of. Don't ask that question, well, I don't come from... I think a lot of people have a hard time, and to a degree. We don't want you to reroute your lives in yeshiva, but we want you to think about it. We want you to make decisions, not just for a year or two, but see potentials and orient your lives around them, whether that means rabbinic, whether that means Israel, whether it means Torah, whatever it means not just following the trajectory that you came here with. I used to work for a rabbin. I was very... reductive. He says things in a very reductive fashion. Well, he likes to reduce it down, strip it to the bone, you know, to get your attention. So strip things to the bone, suddenly you have to shake people up. So he would say these things that are very, very alarming just to get attention. So he would say in his inimitable voice, you know when your year ends? When you get off the plane. What do you mean? I just got off the plane. The year is beginning. What do you mean, Rabbi? The year is just beginning. How could the year end? He says, because now you ask which class to go to and which room to go to. You're just filling out your year. Right? You go through your year and you're just playing by motion. You're just going through a year to be a good boy like you were in high school. It's not about being a good boy. It's not about doing the right thing. It's about identity. It's about sculpting your identity based on values that are on display that no one's indoctrinating, but that they're positioning and projecting. And now take these values and let them really affect your plans and affect your identity. And that's hard. And that if you don't pay attention, you're not doing that. If you slumber through that, you're wasting your year. So you'd say, if you don't pay attention to that, essentially you're now just going through the routine like a rat on the spin wheel, just doing what is expected of you. So that's one difference between Kalev and Yehoshua. Kalev makes himself. Kalev fashions himself. Kalev starts a tradition. Okay, he comes from, according to Chazal, he comes from Miriam's stock, but he certainly doesn't have that special relationship with Moshe Rabbeinu, that special interaction with Moshe. When Yeshua closes his eyes in the heat of the moment and he has to gain strength, I imagine he's got Moshe's image right in front of him. He's got Moshe's image, and that's compelling, and that's reinforcing, and that lends him confidence, and he thinks Moshe believes in him because Moshe called him in and gave him that mission. And Kalev has to find it, and Kalev has to make it, and Kalev has to snatch it from his past from hundreds of years before. But he becomes successful in some ways in a manner that Yeshua can. So don't let that ever become your, oh, I don't come from that, or I'm not. I think a lot of boys who can and should and maybe are able to, they're suddenly, they enfeeble themselves by saying, yeah, but I didn't come from that background, or I don't come from, that wasn't my past. I didn't have that inner voice. I remember a story. There is a Rebbe who was very ill, who was a Rebbe in Yeshiva called Rav Tabori. You may have heard of him. His son goes to Camp Stones. He probably had the younger of Tabori, and Yara comes along to the base medrash. So it was very interesting. Because when I was dating my wife, I was going through a bit of a identity search. What do I mean? I knew I loved her. I wasn't like questioning that. I knew who I was. I wasn't questioning that. But I knew that I wanted to enter the Rabbanus. I wanted to enter the world of Torah. And at least the way I was brought up in my world, there's a certain voice that said, okay, then you marry, especially in the Haredi world. If you're going to get anywhere, you have to marry the right people. You can't just marry average people in the street. You have to marry the Rosh Hashiva's daughter in order to be hired. One of the differences, when I entered Chinuch, my father finally recovered after a seventh heart attack. That's the Baruch Hashem, he's healthy. But if he finally got through the sense that he wanted to enter Chinuch and finally wrapped his head around it, and I'm not going to be a brain surgeon or a rocket scientist and Nobel Prize, I'm like I'm supposed to be, right? It's his son. All of a sudden, like, he said, okay, but I don't understand. So then you have to marry the right person, right? And you don't marry the right person, you'll never get anywhere. Yeah, that's because to a large degree, maybe it's changing, but it's classically in the Haredi Torah world, the way you advance is through marriage. And if you're not married or you don't have the bloodlines, you can be the biggest Talmid Chacham in the yeshiva, you just don't advance. And it's not conspiratorial. It's not like you're sitting in the back. And it's just the way it's run. This yeshiva is run as a meritocracy. It's run by a board of supervisors, and we all answer to them. Obviously, they don't ask us to they don't test us. We have a certain degree of freedom, but this is yeshiva. That's a public organization. And it's run by public representatives. Of course, we appoint those representatives, but it's run by people who represent the needs of the broader public who are donating their funds to the yeshiva, like any yeshiva, like the high schools you went to. In the Haredi world, Yeshivas, by and large, are family operations. Essentially, you own the yeshiva. It's your yeshiva. It's your money. It's your... That's why sometimes when you have these conflicts, it's just cultural differences. They're not conflicts. Just we're run as public organizations. Those Torah organizations are run. It's the family. I want to appoint my son. So the point, when a promotion was hired, he wasn't hired. There was a search committee. That was serious. Everybody was called in. I was asked to give two or three recommendations for the replacement, and we all gave recommendations, and then the search committee conducted a search committee, and they decided Rav Moshe would be the best choice. So it's not like our Ravon called him in and said, you're the one, and everyone's outside kicking and screaming. So my father only knew the Haredi world, so he said, well, if you want to be a Rebbe, you got to marry the right person. You can't just be a Talmud Chacham, you got to marry the right person. So here I was, engaged or about to become engaged to the most wonderful person I ever met in my life, madly in love with her, but you know, she comes from a family. She's a nice Jewish family, wonderful people, incredible people, but her parents aren't Rabbanim, her grandparents aren't Rabbanim, that's not a rabbinic family. So at that point, Rav Tirvori's mother had passed away. So I, being a Talmud in the yeshiva, went to Rav Tirvori's mother's funeral just to be there for Rav Tirvori. And I went to the funeral, and part of one of the hespedim was like one of these best time to spadim, not that a spadim would ever be timed well, but for me in my life, it was because why they were talking about, and I always reminded him when I spoke with them about this, they were always talking about in the spadim how this mother had grown up in Wacom and Chew, some nowhere's land, as the daughter of a farmer, and not really the part of a rabbinic dynasty. And at that point, I decided, I was walking in the cemetery. I don't know if I was holding the mitzvah or not, but I remember my feet walking on the stones leading up to the cemetery, leading up to the gravesite. And I said, if a woman that comes from wherever, middle of nowhere, some farmland in the middle of America, could raise someone like Rav Tirvori, then this woman who I want to marry is fine for me. It would help me get past that psychological barrier. Because I had a role model that this woman had produced, someone of Rav Tirvori's stature. And I therefore felt comfortable taking that leap. So that's something I think about every year during Parsha Shlach, where I think about how Kalev must have felt invisible to Moshe, didn't have that relationship with Moshe, and wasn't deterred by that from becoming someone great and historical. The second issue that this dichotomy produces, and it's a little bit related, but it's very different, and it's even more important than the first issue. Some people are Moshe, some people are Kalev, you need to be both. Namely, Some people are immersed in the Yeshua experience. The Gedolim who live contemporary, my Rebbeim, what do my Rebbeim say? What's Das Torah? What do they believe here and now about this issue? The recents, the Gedolim, the Rosh Yeshivos. And it creates a bit of a historical myopia. We have great Rabbanim, we have great leaders today, we have great, call it Das Torah, call it, but think about the entire sweep of Jewish history. Kalev thinks about the Avos 400 years earlier and the challenges they faced and Avram's experiences, discovering HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Yitzchak's experiences that Moshe never encountered. The Akedas Yitzchak, whatever Moshe encounters, he was never an Ekad al Gabi HaMizbeach. And he never lived the life of Yaakov. And these people were pioneers. They were literally in the Wild West of Indians. And they were holding down the fort. Moshe Rabbeinu comes into a different reality. So Moshe is contemporary, and Yahushua draws contemporary voices. The Avos are historical, and Kalev draws historical voices. And you need a blend of the two. So some people, they're so engrossed in the contemporary voices, and the extreme would be they imagine that Moshe Rabbeinu wore a black hat. Because all they can encounter is the contemporary scene, and it's easy to be trapped that way because it takes vision, imagination, collective memory to go back and say that your reality is not the only reality. You get stuck in your reality. You get stuck in your experience. Right here, right now, the recency bias. Right here, I'm living in 2019. You think, well, wait a second. What was life like for Jews in the 16th century? What was life like for Jews in the 12th century? What was life for Jews in Tunisia, Jews in Yemen, Jews in Babylonia, Jews in Alexandria? Obviously, it's not as monolithic and single dimension as you may feel Judaism or Avodas Hashem is based on contemporary models. It's just this is how it is in 2019. So you have to have that infusion of historical perspective that Kalev receives by visiting Maras HaMechpelah, by visiting Kivri Avos, by tapping into the experience of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and of course the Imams. And then you've got the other extreme, where people deflect contemporary voices and say, oh yeah, these Rabbanim may hold that, but the Rambam would have said such and such about this, this, and this. One of my favorite lines is a great phrase. I call it historical ventriloquy. It's easy to make the Rambam say what you like him to say. You put him on your lap like a little dummy and make him say what you want. He's dead. He can't respond. If the Rambam were alive, he would support whatever, fill in the blanks. How do you know? The Rambam wouldn't even imagine the questions we're dealing with today. The Rambam's world, women were raving idiots. They weren't educated. It wasn't because he was a misogynist. How would he even begin to understand? It was such a different reality. If the Rambam were alive today, how do you know? It's a deflection. I don't have to listen to the rabbi because I'm a Rambam. I love that. I ain't going to like the Ramban. I don't have to listen to these Rabbanim. I'm the Rebbeinu Kruskas. Like, come on. That's so transparent. Are we trying to fool? What? Rebbeinu Kruskas got through a car. Please slow down. You know, where are the horses? You know, where's the manure? Where's the outhouse? He would be a supporter of the internet, or you know, the Torah Mata, or women's this, or come on! It's laughable. Binush knows Dar Vadar, Zechariah Mazzola. And sometimes you've got extremism in both directions. You've got people locked into their own world who can't imagine anything other than Yiddish speaking, black hatted Hasidim eating pachar or something. You know, that's a mushroom painted. There are other Jews and other, and the more you travel, the more you realize, and to a degree, this is in no way a denigration, chas v'chalila, and you know, it's just a public article in one of the Mishpacha magazine quoting me, I love the Haredi world, but to a degree, this is why I'm not in the Haredi world, because I don't see Torah and Avodah Hashem that there is, this is the way, and this is the veg, and this is the dress, and this is the talk, and this is the red, and this is, and like what I don't exist as. My shir could be great, my shir could be terrible. Doesn't make a difference. I don't dress the way, I don't have the masara that's important, I don't tell the right story. I'm not saying this in a bad way, I'm just trying to give you context. It's not just about your Torah and your Yerah Shemayim and your, it's also about fitting into the way, fitting into the context, the derech, the masara, the, and if you don't, I don't view Torah that way. I view Torah and Avodah Hashem as cosmic, as uncontainable by any human convention or any social norm or any form of dress, and it's something that cascades amongst every single Jew, and some learn more and some learn less, and some, it's just a different view of Torah. I can't lock myself, and I don't say lock that I'm denigrating that they're all locked up and jammed up. I just can't lock into that view. To me, it's just too surpassing and too historical and too broad, and it's not, oh, if you're not in Lakewood or Panavish or whatever, then you're not in. It's just not how I feel about it. It's not how it hits. That's not how Torah hits me. And they would, if they were here, they would give a different response to Torah. That there is a Masara that develops, and you have to be within that Masara, or else it doesn't make a difference whether you can't just have a Gemara. You can't just have a Mesil Sashem. You can't just have a Minyan. You have to have what the Gedolim and how Torah has evolved. Again, I'm very poor at articulating it because I'm not part of that world, so you'd have to have people paraphrasing it better. So on the one hand, you need that historical perspective. There's been 2,000 years of history since the Beis Hamikdash. On the other hand, you need recency bias because contemporary poskim have more to say, contemporary voices, contemporary Musar, whatever it is, they're going to be better able to respond to realities and experiences they've encountered than hypothesizing what, I don't know, what Rav Amram from Babylonia would say about living in Brooklyn. Like, who is to know? I mean, it's such a good historical ventriloquy. You can make them say whatever you want them to say. That's silly. That's irresponsible. Let me give you an example. I was like grounding you in story. You want to talk about stories. So I was once a visiting rabbi, a lot of visiting rabbis, sounds like my profession, and it was open mic. Ask the rabbi any question. I think this was a tough crowd. It was a Los Angeles crowd. They asked like really provocative questions. So one of the questions they asked was Parshas Vayetze. And they said, did Yaakov kiss Rachel? The classic conundrum, the catch 22, right? I know where this is heading. Like, this isn't my first rodeo. I felt like a little bit insulted. Like, can you at least treat me with respect? Don't try to trip me on these easy ones. I've been around. Did the rat? Oh yeah, you're gonna try to snare me on that one? Please, you know, respect me. You're wasting my time. It's batting practice in me. But what's the trap? If I say he didn't kiss, that's intellectual dishonesty. If I say he did kiss, oh, how are you going to get out of that one? So I said to him, look, let's take a few steps back. Once you take a few steps back, you're in my territory, okay? You're now in the zone of Rav Lichtenstein. It's not about the question, it's about the overall issue, okay? I'll get to your question in 2 hours. Now let's talk about the issue. Come into my world where it's an even fight. Okay, what I tell him, I said, look, there are layers to Jewish history. And basically, you can divide Jewish history basically into four periods. There's the pre-Sinai period of 2,500 years. It's pretty long. It's longer than the current. 2,500 years, human history. Not Jewish history, but human history that morphs into Jewish history the last 400 years. Then there's Har Sinai, 2448, more or less. Let's extend it largely, generously, to the period of the Churban HaMikdash Sheni. Obviously, the Bayis Sheni wasn't the same as the Bayis Rishon. Obviously, there's an intervening Galus, but prophecy, revelation, supernaturalism, Am Yisrael is more universalist, certainly the first Beis HaMikdash, even in the second Beis HaMikdash. Even though the second Beis HaMikdash is no Nevuah, you still have the Beis HaMikdash, you still have the Kohen Gadol. It's still a different feel. 2,000 years of Galus. And now we believe we're entering the period of redemption and the restoration of revelation and the end of history. And if you don't believe 48 is that, but it will come. Like, we're not arguing the structure now. Someone that doesn't believe in Dinas Yisrael is Yad Hashem, so whenever it will, but he still believes in four quadrants. There are four stages. And I think the Jewish experience has to be fed by all four of them. We have to be historically conscious of all four. What do I gain from the Avos? What do I gain? Like, what does it mean to go back to Malchus Beis David? What does it mean to be... And that's why the restoration of Tanakh is so important, to clue you in to that period that Tanakh discusses. That was this big gaping hole. The Avos everyone knows, Avram on the beach, Avram in the stars, Yitzchak in the Akedah. More or less everyone knows what that period is from the stories and the fables. And the Golos, we'll talk about in a moment, that we've lived it for 2,000 years. It's in our blood, it's in our DNA. It's the period of that 1,000 years or so, from our Sinai, 12, 13 years, our Sinai to the end of the second Beis HaMikdash, that you really need Tanakh to help you at least set the baseline. You're not going to understand it, second Beis HaMikdash, but at least the baseline of where it comes from. You don't know where it comes from. You know, the Yoshio. You have to know a little bit about the first Beis HaMikdash, at least make sense of Galus Babel, make sense of the second Beis, make sense of Ezra, make sense of Anshe Knesset Gedolah. They're not in Tanakh, but you know a little bit of Ezra, you get a sense of where the Anshe Knesset Gedolah stood. And then you can follow through on the Mishnayos and get a sense of that period. The last 2,000 years is the rabbinic tradition, as I call it. Galus, Taurus Shebaal Peh. Gemara in Brachos, Biyom Shenechra Beis HaMikdash Ein LaKadosh Baruch Hu Bolam LaDalad HaMashal Halacha. Jewish world contracts. We're no longer sovereign. We no longer have a nation. We no longer influence the world. We no longer run it. We're scattered. Mefuzim Mefarad. And we contract, but we've got one thing. The Beis HaMedrash. Halacha. Torah. Nothing. We don't need anything else. Because Torah is cosmic. Torah is history altering. We don't need anything else. Everything's in Torah. And forget about that fourth period, because even if we're there, we're at its incipient stages. So place yourself right at that scene, let's say. Let's say you live in 47, or for someone that doesn't believe 48 is redemptive, even 2019. You have to be affected by all three. But the proportion can't be the same. The greatest impact is the most recent. The greatest impact is going to be the Noda Behuda, the Chassam Sofer, the Rambam, the Ramban, based on what I said before, because they're more contemporary. So their impact on society, and on not society, Jewish society, but on Jewish thought and Jewish experience has to be more powerful than, I don't know, Ezra. Because Ezra wasn't dealing with some of the realities that the Ramban was dealing with, that we're dealing with. The same way that Ezra's impact has to be more disproportionate. I'm not saying greater, because Avram's impact is more sweeping. Put Avram into Fifth Avenue and it just doesn't go. So you have to be sensitive to all three, but you have to be more sensitive to the more recent ones. So how did this answer this wisecracker's question about Yaakov Kissin? Well, Rachel, I said, I can completely entertain the fact that Yaakov kissed Rachel. Because in those days, there's nothing wrong with Yaakov kissing Rachel because their sexual norms were such that it meant nothing. Or even if it didn't mean it wasn't sexually charged, or it didn't have any sexual innuendo. And in the pre-Sinai era, there's nothing wrong with a unmarried man kissing his long-lost cousin who he hopes to marry. But if you believe that Negiah is Asr Min HaTorah, as the Ramban suggests, or whether Negiah is a Gzera Derabana, Negiah Shel Chiba, so all of a sudden, different stages offer different... So just because Yaakov in part A of history, it's because Yaakov in part A kisses Rachel, doesn't mean me in part D, having had those two influences of part B and part C, should kiss unmarried women. And I tried to give him that sense. It's not about this question or this answer, but about that historical sweep and the historic, a holistic view of Jewish history and how it impacts you, but shaded towards the more contemporary positions. And that's the message of Shlach. You need both. You can't be locked into the mode, the Yeshua mode. You can't be locked into the Kalev mode. That's why the Torah presents them as complementary, as a complete package. You need Rabbanim. You need to know what contemporary people have to offer. Again, do you believe it? It's absolutely binding. That's what Das Torah people say, that you ask Rabbanim, not just when it comes to Halacha. Again, I was asked this because of that article. Someone was shocked. They don't believe in Das Torah. As if it's, I don't believe in Samchus Chachamim. Of course I do. I believe in Samchus Chachamim absolutely, unwaveringly, unquestionably, without any hesitation when it comes to halacha questions. If I need to know what the halacha is, I have to seek a posek who is of a higher level of knowledge and authority than myself, and certainly a higher posek and go up the chain. And when it comes to moral issues, okay, so moral issues aren't black and white, like a question of Basa B'chalav. Even Bas B'chalav isn't black and white, but it's more or less black and white. Moral questions of growth. How should I grow as an Oved Hashem? What's this derech? What's that derech? Hashkafa. So they're not black and white, but certainly you want to speak to Rabbanim and look at yourself before you look at other communities. How many, I've said this so many times this year, how many Jews in our world simply have no rabbinic voices in their world, in their lives? They're just completely, completely self-arbitrary. I just decide what's right for me. I just make my own decisions. That's terrible. And it's almost as if the best way to encompass for your own avodas Hashem is ask yourself at every stage of your life, which rabbinic voice, and it doesn't have to be a formal rabbi, but which Torah personality, am I going to go to, not just for halacha l'maisa questions and for Torah knowledge, but for questions that are of religious or moral nature? Because the assumption is that someone that has studied Torah assiduously, intensely, and properly, right? You have to make sure that they're a proper person. You can study a lot of Torah and be morally decrepit, but... So it's a morally inspiring person. That combination should be the source of your guidance. And that's why any question I ever had about life, I went to Rav Aaron about it. But he never said, do this, do that, because they weren't halacha questions. When I asked him a halacha question, he said, do this, do that. I never went to Rav Aaron to ask about investments in the stock market. I played the stock market for about 5 minutes. I lost too much money, so forget it. So when day trading was just becoming cool, and you dialed up into your AOL account and you placed 100 shares or whatever, and they said, oh, this is not for me. I'm not going. But I didn't go to Rav Aaron and say, should I put it into Intel, which I should have, or should I put it into whatever I did, Bozo the Clown stock or something, which I didn't. I didn't ask him that advice. I didn't ask him about my cars. I didn't ask him about my marriage. I didn't ask him about which shirt to wear. There's medical procedures. There is an assumption that's out there, and that's very dominant, that no, that you should ask them at political voting because they've got access. And the truth is, cute, I once asked Rav Aaron about this, I think it was once asked at Tish, he said he does believe in Das Torah, but just not in our period. There's no one who could practice it. Namely, in theory, if you had supernatural information, not just Torah knowledge, then you would be able to give supernatural guidance about amoral issues, not just about moral issues, but about cars, houses, stocks. So if, in theory, if you were a Navi, I'd say, oh, yeah, invest there. I could offer that information. If a Navi had nothing better to do with his time than make stock recommendations. But in theory, you could suggest information that was unavailable to people through rational permutations or rational computations. But it's just, we don't have that anymore. It's because you've learned Shas a lot of times, and you're Shalit Kol Torah Kula. It's not supernatural. It's just knowing Torah very, very deeply. So you have to find that. You can't just use the past as a smokescreen for avoiding the authority of the present. Right? It's a good phrase. Don't use the past or as a distraction. Oh, I don't have to listen because the Rambam says so-and-so. I don't have to listen because... No. Different periods. You ever hear this phrase in the contemporary voice? My grandfather was a very religious person and he went mixed dancing. My father was a very religious person and he did... Okay, the period was different. Half the people in this room are Jewish because of mixed dancing. Because if not for mixed dancing, they'd be at the pubs intermarrying with Christians. That's how powerful the cultural influences were. Mixed dancing saved Am Yisrael. One of the greatest things that ever happened. Saturday night, come to shul and hang out with Jews. One day you'll marry Jews, because the pressure not to marry Jews was so intense. I promise you that any of these zealous, fanatical 25-year-old swamis, if they were rabbis in 1940, they'd be not just running the mixed dancing, they'd be out there making the moves. Because these were people saving Judaism. Mixed dancing and mixed swimming and whatever, all these. Okay, this, that. I think there's some Gemara in Sanhedrin where Rav Ashi was speaking about Menashe, one of the terrible Jewish kings. It was Ovid Avodah Zarah. And he made some rude comment, some dismissive comment. Tomorrow we're going to study our good friend Menashe, you know, that great sinner. So the king Menashe came to him in a dream and said, you should only know what it was like living in our period. If you had been in my period where the desire for Avodah Zarah was so profound and so acute, you would have lifted your garment, your toga, running after Avodah Zarah, Mr. Rav Ashi, Condescending. Oh, let's talk about my good friend Menashe. You don't know what these periods were like. But it's also an escape. So therefore, I'm not going to keep whatever level of Shemiras HaMitzvos may be possible and incumbent and mandatory in 2019 because my grandfather was a very religious person and he went... So people run away to the past as a refuge to avoid challenges in the contemporary situation. Let's go back to the past so we can escape. We don't have to follow. It's ridiculous. I heard a story. There's something to tell the MTA guys. In America, it's now this summer. So you've got an incredible phenomenon that you can't even imagine. Seriously. Okay, how many Jews are there in Australia? 60,000? 12,000? 40 to 50,000. 100,000 Jews. Okay. You've got probably six times that amount of Jews who migrate from New York City to the country for the summer. I think estimates are about 500,000 Jews move into the Catskills. And it's like putting up a circus. Like all of a sudden you've got pop-up tents. The entire Jewish supermarkets and Jewish dentists and Jewish doctors and Jewish taxis. And Jewish this and Jewish, I mean, it's just like a whole... Now what's happening is because demographically it's hard to live in New York, so these places are becoming inhabited by Orthodox Jews even during the year-round. You can go up all the way up in the mountains and find Yeshiva in South Fallsburg, for those who know what I'm talking about. But it's amazing. It's just an amazing anthropological study that you all of a sudden you've got pop-up societies, pop-up malls, pop-up kosher stores, pop-up... It's just fascinating to watch. It's just from a human perspective. Okay? What was I talking about? Where was I going with this? Oh, okay. So someone told me a story. An older person told me a story that in Queens, big Jewish area, not Queensland, Queens, big Jewish area, he was rolling his stroller with his child on the street September. People come back from the country September 1st. He was rolling his stroller September 1st in Queens on Shabbos, and everyone's making these like rude looks at him. Are you rolling your stroller on Shabbos? It's real. He said, what am I doing wrong? We've all been rolling strollers for the last 20 years together. Everyone's like looking at him, phew, what are you doing? And he finally asked his best friend, why is everyone giving me these eyes? Why is everyone looking at me this way? He says, oh, you in the country. The rabbi over the summer, those days it wasn't as popular to go to the country, decided that now's the right time to tell us that we're not allowed to push our strollers on Shabbos. You missed that memo. You missed that update because you were in the country during Parshas Veschanan. When the rabbi finally made this breakthrough announcement, what's the backstory? The rabbis had to decide what to prohibit and what to prohibit. Like, they had to decide. These are real halachas. These are not what hashgacha. Oh, now let's all choose a higher hashgacha because these are isurim, d'oraisa, that the rabbanim couldn't tell people because no one would keep it. It wasn't even in the lexicon. Shmir Shabbos was a slowly evolving norm, and even in North America. So the Rabbanim had to decide, well, you know, let's talk about this, but not this. No one's going to really know about what we're talking. Let's issue this and not issue. And then 1962, whatever that story took place, the rabbi felt like it's time to debut this newsflash. You're not allowed to be over Hotzah on Shabbos, something called Hotzah on Shabbos. Oh, this guy, this poor soul, missed it because he was in the country. So, okay, history evolves. And that's why it's so hard sometimes when you tell your parents you want to go shana bet, you want to do this, you want to do that. My greatest dream is that my kids should be more firm than me. And I don't see this as an indictment of me. I just see this as, you know, I grew up in a very different world, and I'm proud of what I accomplished, and I worked, sweat, and clawed my way to what I accomplished, and now I'm a platform. And in a larger historical perspective, we're rebuilding the lost Masorah of the Holocaust. I mean, there's so much of Yiddishkeit, it's Masorah, and what you saw. And I'm old enough, I'm a second generation Holocaust. And my parents were children of Holocaust survivors. I'm a grandchild of Holocaust survivors. I know what it is to grow up in a world of Holocaust survivors. I know that world. It's a very, very dark place. It's a very lonely place. It's a very angry place. It's a very non-communicative place. It's a place without the Seder tables that you know. It's a very quiet Seder table with three or four people at the Seder table. And it's a place that children aren't welcome, because some of these people literally saw children being mowed down and gunned down. They couldn't have children in their presence. Literally, they couldn't even be in with the presence of children. It's a different... So, and now look at the Pesachs you've had, and look at the traditions you've had, and look at the Masorahs, like what you picked up in your homes. So we're rebuilding. And each generation advances beyond the previous generation. And it's that historical perspective. Where are we, and where are we heading, and what each person's role is, and what each generation is capable of. So you can't have historical deflection, but you can have historical perspective. Some people use history to deflect. Some people use history to proportionize, to perspectivize, to create that context. And that's the balance between Yehoshua and Kalev. Yehoshua gets it from Moshe. And you have to, you can't, oh, what would Avram have said? Avram wasn't in the desert. Avram didn't face Paro. It's different. What is Moshe? But it can't just be Moshe. There's a rich history of people. And that's the duality. So there are two dualities between Yehoshua and Kalev. One duality is it the personal relationship, or if you don't have it, build it. You be that first one. You be the first one to build it. You be the one that says, okay, that person didn't come from a rabbinic family, he built it. Go back to you. Everyone here comes from a Kalev. It's just to go back far enough. It's obvious, right? We all come from Avram. We all come from great people. So if you're looking, okay, you didn't have that great Kalev, find it. Find it in yourself. Find it in your heritage. To do that great thing and to live the life that's worthy of meaning, not just of listlessness and just following the crowd and just looking for the next deal and the next salary, of meaning and of profound impact upon Jewish history and Jewish Torah. So that's one. The second is try to balance between Yehoshua and his relationship with Moshe and Kalev in his historical perspective. We're out of time, I'm sorry. So we go back to Moshe, maybe one more thing. What I wanted to talk about was how to deal with panic. I'll just leave you with one line. There's a thin boundary between precaution and panic. Learn the difference. Precaution is legitimate. Panic is a chisaron yirashamayim and emunah. You have to know how to respond to dangerous situations, how to challenges. We've lived in this country for 71 years. I've lived in this area for 36 years. Sometimes in a more difficult, sometimes in a less difficult. Precaution. It's an attitude. I'm not saying what you should do. Believe me, but plenty of people left during the Second Intifada, and no one judged them, and no one said people moved out of Gush Etzion, no one judged them, no one said, but it's a question of tone. Pesioner, perspective. Sky's not falling, more difficult periods in Jewish history, it's just a question. It's not a question of how you respond only, but how you process and what your attitude is. And the Baragim don't get the right dosage. They find hardship and adversity and challenge and big people and giants, and it goes all south, and there's panic and screaming and crying and projection, and we're grasshoppers, they're grasshoppers, we're afraid, it's all discombobulated. That's called panic. You know you're panicking when you project your fears onto others. We felt like grasshoppers, and they saw us that way. Did you interview them? Did you ask them how you see us? Maybe there's always a pretty scary grasshoppers. They got teeth. These are scary grasshoppers. You assume. Don't ever assume how people are looking at you. Once you get into that space, you get really, really lost. It's an old Kasko in Parshat Shlach. The real chisaron was not their lack of emunah, but they even went to that place where they're worried about what people say about them. And we felt belittled, and they also looked at us that way. At that point, you know that. Don't care about that. Don't right or wrong. Don't go to that place. You'll waste your time and your energy endlessly speculating. What does he think? What does she think? What? It's quicksand. It's mental quicksand. Just don't fall into that trap. And there's a pasuk in Devarim that they said this is classic. Oh, the reason Hashem took us out of Mitzrayim is
because he wants us to die in the desert because he hates us. B'sinas Hashem otzi'enu me'eretz Mitzrayim. This is all a big trap. Really? I can think of a lot of reasons Hashem wants to kill them in the desert. And some of them make sense. Hashem's, I mean, that makes sense, but Hashem's too weak, they're rebellious. But the last thing, if you really hate someone, it's really hard to be so kind to them and to liberate them. If you hate them, let them rot away in Egypt. So kind to them, redeem them, man. The real reason is because he hates us. What does Rashi say? An old farmer's fable. Who hated whom? It's not like Hashem hated them. They hated Hashem. And they're projecting their own hatred to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's psychology 101. You project your own flaws to people around you because they're easy to deal with. Oscar Wilde, right? Dorian Gray. It's hard for me to come to terms with my own flaws. Best way, oh, my wife, my children, my parents, my... That's why it's so hard to get along with people close to you. Those are just easy targets for projection. You know them so well, you can just fit in your own flaw. He's got that. So it's easier to deal with. It's a coping mechanism. You've got to avoid that. So here, it's panic and projection and fear and crying and screaming and complaining. That's all. Don't go there. Project. Okay, so you know, it's hard to live in Eretz Yisrael, so I'm going to move from this place. But not the fear and the caricatures and the sky's falling and I've got to run and it's terrible and that's all Morocco. Okay, so we'll stop here. Sorry about that. It's nice to be in this room though. Baruch atah Adonai Elohim, Melech HaShem, Blessed be the Lord.